One of Baltimore's biggest parks is home to some 200 different species of birds. For many, like the black-throated blue warbler or the city's own Baltimore oriole, it's a stop on a long annual migration to Mexico and Central America. Lately, the birds are getting help from a crew of women, former migrants, who settled in Baltimore after their own long journeys from Latin America. NPR's Lauren McGaughey reports.
A couple of times a month, in the middle of Baltimore's expansive Patterson Park, you can hear the chatter of women and kids as they haul bags of mulch and dig holes to plant shrubs and flowers. The women are building habitats for migratory birds as a part of the Patterson Park Audubon Center's Bird Ambassadors program.
Some of the plants feed the birds directly, with nectar or seeds, for example, but some of them are feeding insects, beneficial insects, that are then food for birds.
Susie Creamer is the director of Audubon's Urban Education and Conservation in Patterson Park.
If you think about a bird flying above up the East Coast, city after city, seeing a big chunk of green right here is a great spot to stop, rest, and refuel.
The birds migrate from the East Coast down to places like Mexico and Central America for the winter. The women tending the park's gardens are themselves migrants from some of those very same places. To them, the birds' journeys look a lot like their own. When Creamer first considered inviting migrant women to participate in an environmental effort for migrating birds, she hesitated.
What I thought at first, is it a cheesy connection? Is this kind of silly?
But there was a real connection. Because the orioles, swifts, and warblers that inhabit Patterson Park are not just the same species. They're the very same birds the women knew back in their home countries.
The same individuals are traveling thousands of miles twice a year. And because many of them have traveled that distance, they know exactly how far that is. And so when I first mentioned it to them, it was literally an audible, oh, the same individual birds. And there was this sense of like, oh, say hi to grandma for me. You know, saludos a Mexico.
They call these birds neotropical migrants. Alexandra Gonzalez recognized some of the birds from her former home in Mexico. So did her husband.
Ellos se la comían asada. De hecho, mi esposo me dijo,
he used to grill them. My husband joked that we should grab one and grill it, but I said no. They're visiting and migrating. When I see them here, it reminds me of my garden back home in Mexico.
Delfina Cotto is also a part of the program. She migrated from El Salvador to Baltimore.
Pero lo importante es cultivar de las raíces que nosotros traemos.
The important thing is to cultivate the roots that we bring from our countries and how to identify what we have in common with these birds. The birds migrate from the north to the south, to the Caribbean, Central America, and Mexico, just like us. That's what we have in common with our birds.
There's a chimney swift.
The program started with Audubon's visits to local schools, but Creamer quickly realized that it wasn't just the kids who were interested in learning about the birds.
We were doing a little nature scavenger hunt, and I had this grandmother who took off running, ditched the kids, left them behind to find the next thing on the scavenger hunt. And it was like she was as excited for hands-on nature-based learning as the kids were.
The effort to build bird habitats has spread beyond Patterson Park. The bird ambassadors have added plants and shrubs to schools and dozens of row houses nearby. At one school, an old canoe has new life as a giant planter.
The birds are now arriving to eat here. Before, we just feed them bread, but now it's the plants that feed them. And my neighbors congratulate me because all of us now have shrubs and plants in front of our homes.
National Audubon Society leaders say the Patterson Park Project is a new model, a way to enlist immigrants in the effort to protect migratory bird populations. Lauren McGaughey, NPR News.
In California, residents are being urged to conserve water as the state suffers from a historic drought. But a new report says the state's water use has actually gone up over the last year. California enacted statewide water restrictions this week. Those include fines of up to $500 a day. Now, to find out what actually gets people to cut their water use, NPR's Sam Sanders hit the streets of L.A.
Rick Silva has just pulled up on a violator.
Hey, I'm with LADWP.
Did you know there was an ordinance and there's watering restrictions?
Silva is a water conservation specialist for LA's Department of Water and Power, or DWP. Think of him as a water cop. He's having a talk with gardener Ricardo Diaz.
Do you come once a week or something? You have to get water on once. Right now or something? Or
no, just right now that I just saw the lawn that was kind of dry.
Brown spot.
So, yeah, I was just hitting the drying spot.
It's a coverage problem.
Yeah.
Silva's been doing this for a while, and he likes it.
Water conservation probably for the last 10 years or so. And I do like it because it's a positive thing that you can pass on information, help people save water, help them save money, too.
Silva is one of only four full-time water cops for a city of almost 4 million people. There are two part-timers, and the city plans to hire three more. By comparison, Los Angeles has 570 full-time parking enforcement officers. Jim McDaniel is a senior assistant general manager at LADWP, and he says those numbers are just fine.
I look at it as not parking, but I think of it as kind of like people running red lights and stuff. You don't need to have a police officer at every stoplight to make people not run red lights. You know, have enough people out there so that people know, yeah, there are people watching, but we just know what the right thing to do is.
McDaniel says that of LA's $30 million water conservation budget, only 3% is spent on enforcement. 85% goes towards incentive programs.
Rebates for plumbing fixtures, high-efficiency toilets, free low-flow showerheads. We have very generous rebates for low-water use appliances. We're actually paying people $3 a square foot to take out their lawns.
A lot of carrot, a little stick. Is that good?
Spending the least on enforcement makes sense to me. I don't know that spending a lot more would do much better.
That's Allison Ledgerwood, a psychologist who studies social influence at the University of California, Davis. Ledgerwood says punishment really only works if it does several things.
Punishment works if you have a bunch of conditions in place, including people are pretty sure they would get caught. The punishment has to be consistently applied. It has to be perceived as fair, and the punishment has to be strong enough to deter the behavior.
In a city as big as L.A., doing all of that would be tough. And L.A.'s current incentive-heavy approach is working. The DWP says L.A.'s water use has gone down by 17% over the last 3 years. Hilda Blanco directs the Center for Sustainable Cities at the University of Southern California. She says that the city is doing well, but it could do more through social pressure.
The nudge approach.
Blanco points to Atlanta. In the late 90s, that city began sending water bills that showed more than just your own water use.
It said your own total consumption was so much. Your neighbor's average consumption was this much. And finally, you consume more water than, let's say, 73% of your neighbors.
That tactic cut water use by almost 5%. L.A. hasn't tried something like that yet, but their existing restrictions are already more strict than new ones the state put in place this week. Even so, Rick Silva, the water cop, is just going to give the gardener he caught a flyer.
And this will let you know the watering days that they should be watering, because it's different for even an odd number of addresses. Hand watering's allowed any day.
No fine until he's caught three times. Soon, L.A. will distribute door hangers for people to post on their neighbors' houses when they see them violating water rules. A different kind of social pressure. Shame. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
Tonight, the drought. Governor Brown declared a drought emergency for the state.
A drought emergency has prompted people to start ripping out their lawns, and some people are getting paid.
The fate of the state. California's drought crisis.
Is this the apocalypse?
If you haven't heard, California is in the middle of a big drought. This week, Governor Jerry Brown announced that even though he called on people to reduce their water use by 20%, water use actually went up in some places, like here in coastal Southern California, places where people still water their lawns, wash their cars, and fill their pools. Driving here from our studios in Culver City to here to downtown LA, the sense was you don't really feel like California is in the middle of a drought. Basically, the city is like green with landscaping, and there are fountains running, like the one we're standing in front of right here. And we're here with Molly Peterson, the environment correspondent from member station KPCC. Molly, explain to us why this is happening. Why are fountains like this one on?
Yeah, I feel like I want to defend the city in a certain sense against the onslaught of national attention, but this is recirculated water. And across the street at the headquarters of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, There are fountains that go off mid-morning. They've had them turned off from being full-time since spring because they're leaving the water in so it's not ugly, but they're minimizing the possibility that it's going to be evaporating. So there's some level of concern about this.
Why do some people here in the city still have this sense that there isn't a drought? What is it? I mean,
all the water agencies have emphasized ever since January that we have enough water to keep going this year. So in January, when the governor said we were going to have a drought, and they also said, oh, don't worry, we've got this covered. We've got water in our reserves.
All right, fast forward to this week, and there's these new numbers that are released. In certain places, water use actually went up. In coastal Southern California here, it went up 8%.
Here, it's more complicated because we only even have part of the data to tell us about the 8% going up because we only have voluntary responses from all the big urban water agencies.
Okay, so that those numbers are a little bit misleading.
Yeah, possibly, because San Diego is the community that has refused to give up a lot of its data. And San Diego, in particular, has a high historic gallons per person per day number.
Uh-huh.
And they love their gardens and golf courses.
You've been doing a lot of reporting on a program here in this region that would actually pay people to rip up their lawns and turn their lawns into something else. First, how many people are actually doing that, and does it really make a difference?
They've replaced at least 5 million square feet of turf. That might sound like a lot, but that's a tenth of a percent of the potential irrigated land in a single-family home by our estimate.
Oh, wow. So it's not a whole lot.
No. So the state made some rules this week about limiting outdoor urban water use, only allow outdoor watering 2 days a week, prevent washing down anything, you know, driveways or sidewalks. And then for the water agencies, they're going to have to start coughing up their data about how much water they're actually getting through the tap every month.
That got us wondering, you know, how exactly these officials are going to enforce these rules. And so we asked our colleague, NPR's Sam Sanders, to go out with the one man in Los Angeles who's responsible for doing that.
My full name's Rick Silva, and I'm a water conservation response unit supervisor with the Department of Water and Power, Los Angeles.
Or a water cop. Rick Silva's squad car is a white Honda Civic. His tools are a clipboard and a camera.
We're going to take a look for people that might be irrigating on the wrong day, runoff onto the street, or people washing down hardscapes.
Just a few minutes into his patrol, Silva spots his first violator.
Oh, someone's washing down a trash can. We can stop them.
Silva's approach with Jesse Taranzo is conversational.
Hi. I'm with Water and Power, and we're with Water Conservation Response Unit, because, you know, in the drought, you're not allowed to, you know, wash down stuff. What were you doing? Or
washing the cans.
The cans? There's on the outside?
No ticket this time. Most of Silva's stops don't end in tickets, actually. His approach, the city's approach, is more about education than punishment. They figure once people know what to do, most will do it.
Just so you know, we are in a drought, so...
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. That's why I just keep it up really quick, and that's it.
Yeah, and you are using a shutoff, so that is good, so it's not running continually.
Silva says some people do get upset with him.
A lot of times it starts off that they're very defensive, and, you know, like, what am I doing? Also, when we mail the letters out, it has my phone number on there, and I get a lot of calls with people ready for a fight.
People can also report water violators to Silva over the phone and through email. Silva finds another house in violation. No one's home, but Silva can still issue a warning. He notates a few things on his clipboard.
The time I was here and the type of violation and the address. The violation is watering on the wrong day, and I will also add a line on there concerning runoff.
And so you can tell that they sprinkled even though it's not sprinkling right now.
Right, because the water's there and the grass is still wet.
He takes a picture for evidence. Silva says a big part of his work is letting people know that conservation is a group effort.
We want people just to realize it's a drought, and we're all in it together, and we have to try to, you know, save water, and that's why we have these rules in effect.
And he says conserving water is necessary for LA's survival.
Water, we're not going to find any new sources, right? And we're pretty much tapped out for that. And the only way we're going to meet our future needs is through water conservation.
Spreading that message is Rick Silva's job.
That was NPR's Sam Sanders. And now back to downtown L.A. and our conversation with Molly Peterson, the environment correspondent at member station KPCC. So it sounds like the approach is more about carrots than sticks. that they're not really trying to harshly crack down on people. That right now it's more about soft encouragement. Is that right? Does that work?
Yeah, they're still saying more carrot than stick. They point out that people, power goes out and they start watering on the wrong day of the week because their sprinkler system is automated and it's all messed up. Or their gardener does it and they don't know what's going on.
So yeah, I think it's really important to say that most of California's water is not used by cities, right? I mean, what, 75% to 80% of the state's water is used by farms.
Well, the California Farm Water Coalition would dispute that number, 80%. They say farming isn't that big of a culprit. California is a very, very diverse state economically, and so you have haves and have-nots. Have-nots for water are in El Dorado County, and they're taking bucket showers. And cities are generally haves. Even though there are poor people within them, the cities keep the water on.
That was Molly Peterson, environment correspondent at member station KPCC. That place she mentioned, El Dorado County, is a rural place east of Sacramento near the Nevada border. Officials say 80% of California is now in an extreme drought.
Environmentalists along the coast of Maine are celebrating a victory today. The South Portland City Council has passed a measure that would block Canadian tar sands oil and other crude from being loaded onto tanker ships at the city's port. That ordinance could complicate future plans for a pipeline that runs across northern New England. But as Susan Sharon of Maine Public Radio reports, Canadian crude has other routes into the region.
Known as the place where Liberty ships were built by tens of thousands of workers during World War II, South Portland's waterfront is home to an oil terminal and the beginning of a 236-mile-long pipeline.
Right now we're looking at Portland Harbor, and we're looking at a tanker that's coming in right now.
Jerry Gelbert is South Portland's mayor. For more than 70 years, he says, the Portland-Montreal Pipeline Corporation has pumped crude up through the pipeline that crosses Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont to be refined in Montreal. Canada itself is now in the midst of an oil boom, and the company has expressed interest in using its pipeline to carry Canadian crude in the opposite direction, from Montreal to Maine for delivery to the world market.
And people are concerned what happens if we have a large amount of tankers that are being loaded with crude oil.
That's because the industrial waterfront is changing. The old shipyard has been replaced by a city park with scenic views of the harbor. High-priced condos are a stone's throw away. And Gelbert says residents' concerns about air pollution, the possibility of a spill, and the difficulty of cleaning up a heavier, more toxic form of crude moved the council to ban tar sands.
The Clear Skies Ordinance prohibits the bulk loading of crude oil onto marine tank vessels. It does not affect any current operations.
Current business isn't affected, but the oil industry doesn't like it. Matt Manahan, an attorney for the Portland-Montreal Pipeline Corporation, warned council members before their final vote that he doesn't think it will hold up in court.
This ordinance, if passed, would clearly be preempted by federal and state law. There can be no doubt about that, and it's a mistake to move forward with an illegal ordinance.
Pipeline company officials say they are now evaluating their legal options. They say the ordinance restricts their ability to adapt to a changing market and to meet the energy needs of the region. At least one oil industry analyst is skeptical.
I don't think this is going to make a big difference in terms of northeastern crude oil supply.
Tom Closa is with GasBuddy.com. He says even without the pipeline, Canadian crude is still coming.
One thing we've learned in the last couple of years is that you can move crude oil by rail very, very quickly. I mean, the crude's going to come from the oil sands to the United States and to other points.
That may be true, but Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine says what happened in South Portland is galvanizing activists around the country who are raising awareness about the threat of tar sands.
And they are getting a boost, a shot in the arm, to see citizens in South Portland successful in a persistent effort against all odds and against oil to get their community protected.
If there are problems with the ordinance, if it is too restrictive, Mayor Gelbert says the council can always make revisions. But in the event of a lawsuit, Gelbert says South Portland will defend the ordinance and mount a national online campaign to get environmental groups and other supporters to pay for it. For NPR News, I'm Susan Sharon.
The water temperature of some canals in South Florida has been rising, and that's a problem when the canals are used to cool a nuclear plant. The situation at the Turkey Point plant near Miami has federal regulators concerned, and the plant's closest neighbors are worried too. NPR's Greg Allen explains how the canals work and why the water is getting warmer.
The cooling system at Turkey Point is unlike that used at any other nuclear plant in the country. Instead of cooling towers, water circulates through a 168-mile-long series of canals. Florida Power and Light spokesman Mike Waldron says that water helps keep the plant within safe operating limits.
It cools the non-nuclear side of the power plant and is discharged back out into the canal system. And what it actually does is it allows us to use the same water over and over for cooling.
It's a system that's worked since the plant went online more than 40 years ago. The closed loop of saltwater canals have been successful in another way. They've become prime habitat for American crocodiles, an endangered species that have thrived in the unusual man-made habitat. But in recent months, those cooling canals have run into problems. A shortage of rain and algae growth have been steadily raising the temperature of water in the canals, to the point where it's threatening operations at the nuclear plant. As water temperature in the canals approached 100 degrees, the limit set by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Florida Power and Light went to the commission with an emergency request. The NRC agreed to temporarily allow the nuclear plant's cooling system to exceed that 100-degree limit, up to 103 degrees if necessary. Waldron says the NRC action allows the nuclear plant to keep operating.
It allows us adequate margin to maintain generation during what are very hot and humid summer months in South Florida, while we're also dealing with some of the environmental issues that have caused the canals to become warmer than they typically are.
There are many concerned about what's happening in the canals at Turkey Point. They include state and federal regulators, environmental groups, and the nuclear plant's closest neighbor, Biscayne National Park. Brian Kallstrom is the park superintendent.
We're standing on the one of the docks of Biscayne National Park looking to the south, and the prominent feature on the skyline is the Turkey Point power plant.
You can see the reactor's containment domes from most places in the park, but it's the canals and the poor quality of the water they contain that is Kallstrom's biggest concern. Over the years, with evaporation, the water in the canals has become super saline, at least three times as salty as seawater. Because it's heavier than fresh water, water from the canals has begun sinking into the aquifer. The utility and state regulators are monitoring a plume of super salty water that's now moving into the area's groundwater. Kallstrom says when he learned of new problems in the canals, his first concern was for how they might affect water in Biscayne Bay, where algae is already a problem. So far, he says, the park and the bay have been unaffected.
We're still concerned. Anytime there's that big of a change in a closed system like that adjacent to the park, we want to err with an abundance of caution to make sure that nothing's going to happen that could potentially influence the park.
The utility received permission from state regulators to add chemicals to the canal water to alleviate the algae problem. Also, to bring down the temperature, it's taking 5 million gallons a day of brackish water from the aquifer and adding it to the canals. Roger Hanna with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says rising temperatures in the cooling system don't raise the temperatures of reactors, but they do affect operations.
It does mean that there are some efficiencies lost. And again, we're looking now at what safety implications there may be to see if there are further things or additional information that we may want to know.
The NRC's permission for Florida Power and Light to raise the cooling system's temperature is just for 10 days. The federal agency and the utility are hopeful that by then, increased cloud cover and rain in Florida may provide a natural solution to the problem. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.